On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, happy birthday, West Virginia. Yes, really. Happy birthday, West Virginia. West Virginia is 150 years old today. It's always easy to keep up with West Virginia's age because it's exactly 100 years older than me. It was June the 20th, 1863, in the midst of a brutal, blood-sodden civil war, when Abraham Lincoln signed the existence of West Virginia into being. 150 years of statehood. Although we have been human-occupied for much longer than that. Approximately, let me see. We now know how it is with math on the fly and me. Approximately 10,350 years longer than that. But we all know that only white folks count. It's one of those little privileged thingies. But I'm getting ahead of myself. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. That's our home. That's where the Listen Live button is. It's also where the PayPal button and the snail mail address. Oh, I said snail mail. Years and years. Yeah. It's where the traditional carbon-intensive overland mail address is, either of which you can use in helping to keep us on the air. And maybe it's because I am West Virginian that, I don't know, it's kind of fitting. This is a state that knows poverty and knows it in its most grinding forms. So, hard scrabble is the way a lot of us here live. Consequently, it's not surprising that hardscrabble is the way an independent West Virginia radio network would operate. Yeah. We raised $45 in the last 2 days of broadcasting, which is a great way for this to become a former independent West Virginia-based radio network. Right. However, I have happy news to report. We find ourselves this evening. Let's see. We find ourselves this evening in a $525 fundraising hole. Now, last night, with the story of the preacher who promised everybody a new car of their dreams if they would contribute to help him buy new blades for his freaking helicopter, I offered to guarantee that no one would stub their toes for a couple of days at least if it didn't work. I mean, not at all. Nobody took me up on the toe stubbing. So fortunately, Robert from Australia has come forward with his monthly 20th of the month Down Under challenge and has put $300 on the table, which is perfect, because if we can match that, then we will catch back up and be actually $75 to the good for tomorrow, if we can match Robert's 20th of the month Down Under challenge. In explaining why he did it that way, he said, this month it's $300. I thought I should do it now, as there are rumors of the Aussie dollar about to plummet back to 50 cents on the U.S. dollar, which will make things slightly difficult at this end. Hopefully it doesn't happen. So, indeed, I hope it doesn't, too. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very, very much. He's not able to listen right now. He's at physiotherapy. But thank you, Robert. And hopefully the Horn Family Commune will jump into the breach and match your $300 so that it will look a little bit more like we're going to have a July for the Horn and not just kind of wrap it all up at the end of June, which I don't want to do. But if stuff gets turned off, stuff gets turned off. It happens. Anyway, it is, thank you very much, Robert, and the PayPal button's at headonradionetwork.com if you want to jump in and help alongside Robert to keep this all going. Now, it is the 150th birthday of West Virginia, and I felt like just because outside of, I mean, there will be coverage in West Virginia for-profit media of the 150th anniversary of the creation of this state, but there won't be much mention outside of it, and frankly, this program is heard more widely outside West Virginia than inside it. And over the years, you all have become, in a way, honorary West Virginians, because you have shown time and again that what happens here matters to you. Because we're a part of the United States, at least in theory. So yeah, 150 years of West Virginia. 150 years of, and I suppose it comes as no surprise, bad government. And I'm not one of those people, you know, who says, well, your government's the problem. Well, Mommy, the worst 9 words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Oh, shut up and get back in your crypt, you greasy-headed old freak. No, I think government can be a good thing, a blessing, if you will. But not the way it's been run here. I had actually hoped the idea occurred to me rather late in the day, so it probably won't happen. But I had actually hoped to have Professor Keith Lilly on the program. I couldn't reach him though, to talk about West Virginia's origins. So I guess it follows it falls to me to do it. Like I said, people started coming here to this area that would later become West Virginia about 10,500 years ago. Really, that long. And they set up villages, little towns along waterways. They built earthen pyramids by the streams. They worshipped their deities. They raised their children. And they fed in plenty off of a plenteous land. I get a lot of, it's relative. But from time to time, people will hear me talking about what's going on here, and they will ask a question which has become rather frustrating to me over the years. Well, Bob, with all the problems in West Virginia, why don't you leave? Why do I have to? Why can't I demand the right to live in peace in the same place where my people of one form or another have been living for a very long time? Why must I leave because the coal companies come? Because this is indeed a beautiful place. It is a gorgeous late spring afternoon, late afternoon, evening here. And we could just go walking, you and I. And in a matter of a very short trip, you would begin to speak with awe of the beauty of this place. In the heat of a summer's day, to take recourse to the shade of an oak tree that is bigger around than you can reach. In the cool of the fold of mountains pushed up in a time before humanity, in a time before dinosaurs. It's pretty special. Very special. In places where the water isn't ruined, to see it come bubbling out of a mountainside or out of the ground in the form of a spring, why, the very noise of it will cool you off. But by the time the white folks had pretty well gotten a foothold in the tidewater and flatter regions of old Virginia, other folks were sneaking over this way, even though they weren't supposed to. And they weren't uniformly white English folks either. There was a lot of Scots-Irish, my people, and no small amount of Germans. And they weren't crossing the Allegheny front, they were filtering down through Pennsylvania. It is a little known fact that we hillbillies were there in 1776. It was in 1776, during the American Revolution, and after the first battle of the American Revolution. It wasn't Lexington and Concord. It was at Point Pleasant in what is now West Virginia. It was a battle with native peoples backed by the Crown, and against whom were arrayed some cranky hill folk who wanted to run the native peoples on across the Ohio River. Battle of Point Pleasant. And I can't pronounce it correctly, but I'll do my best, in the native tongue, to Tuendiwe. But during the American Revolution, people who were living beyond the Alleghenies, or, you know, in the Alleghenies, really, created a movement In 1776, they even filed a petition with the Continental Congress to establish something they called West Sylvania. If Pennsylvania means Penn's forest, that's what Silois in Latin means, forest. Well, they wanted to name this state where I live the Western Forest. West Sylvania. That whole Sylvania thing had quite the cachet. At one point in time, it was suggested that that dark and bloody ground, which would later become Kentucky, there was a contingent of people who wanted to name that Transylvania. Really? No kidding. No vampire jokes, please. Blah. But as early as 1776, people realized in this area that they didn't really have much in common with the tobacco planters and slave owners of Virginia. That life here was going to be a vastly different undertaking. That there were no broad and open fields to support slave agriculture. That those who lived here would live here free or die in the attempt. Kind of adds a new meaning to live free or die. We've probably got a better claim to that than those folks up in New Hampshire. Or was that Vermont? Sorry, one way or the other. But something happened as soon as people started coming across here, and, well, some of my people have been here just about as long as white folks have been here. One of them was the first white guy on the Meadow River in what is Fayette County, and he wandered a big chunk of the state for a while with his tomahawk and made notches in trees. It was called laying a tomahawk claim. And he laid claim to the entirety of everything that he had encompassed. Stand by for just a second, please. Hey, happy news. You don't have to hear me do history after all. Professor Keith Lilly is on the phone waiting. I'll just wrap up and say that my multi-great-grandfather, Long Billy McClung, that was his name, laid claim to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of acres and later would give them away as wedding gifts to grandchildren. It all filters, it all thins out after a while and there's not much left. But yeah, been here a while. He was a farmer. Didn't have a damn thing to do with coal. And he had to struggle to keep from being sent to his long home by the aggrieved native First Peoples whose land he was in the process of stealing. That's the other dark secret of West Virginia. Most of this entire state is predicated upon theft at some point or another. But I'm not the guy to talk about this. The guy to talk about this, and I'm really excited, if you've tuned into the PRISM West Virginia American History Chat series chats on the weekends, you know that there is not much history-wise that Professor Keith Lilly doesn't know, and he knows a lot about West Virginia history. So let's bring him on board. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, sir. Sure. Right here.
I am tickled pink that you are. Well, frankly, I'd given up hope because it was such a... I apologize, Keith, because it was late my coming up with the idea. But I sure am glad that you got the message, and I really appreciate you coming on. Where does the history of the state of West Virginia begin for you?
When I teach West Virginia history, and I'm actually teaching West Virginia history course, an upper level course for Concord this summer term, and I'm teaching it with a colleague on the main campus, and I'm on the Beckley campus, and we're doing it through IBN technology. And I go all the way back to the frontier period, and you were talking about land claims and obviously native claims to the land. So I go back that far when I actually teach about the history of the region. When you're actually talking about the origins of the state, really we begin to see the tensions between Eastern and Western Virginia pretty early as well, as early as the 1790s, and certainly by the early 1800s. There are several differences of opinion and different approaches to their futures that we see on the part of Eastern and Western Virginians. In particular, there's political tension, there's political sectionalism, and a lot of that has to do with how the state of Virginia in the antebellum period was apportioned in terms of their government. For example, the Virginia General Assembly in the early 19th century was basically apportioned in the same way as the federal Congress, in which you had one house that had equal apportionment, so all counties had the same number of members, and then the other house was apportioned on the basis of the federal number, which came out of the Three-Fifths Compromise, the idea of, course, the white population and three-fifths of the slave population were calculated in terms of seats in the General Assembly. And so Western Virginians, even in the early 1800s, 1810s, 1820s, really feel that they're being shorted in terms of representation because they have lower numbers of slaves as compared to Eastern Virginia. Now, I'm not saying slavery didn't exist. I think one of the things that has become, kind of fodder for textbooks in West Virginia history is the idea that there were no slaves in West Virginia, but that's certainly not the case. There were certainly areas in which slavery was quite prominent. And West Virginia would be the last state that tries to enter the Union as a slave state. So, the origins go way back. I mean, we can't just basically say that, West Virginia is a child of the Civil War. There's no doubt about that. But the origins, the grievances between the two sections of Virginia go back way into the frontier era. So it's not something that suddenly occurred in the 1860s. But what happened in the 1860s was the circumstances that could bring about a new state. We see sectionalism in other parts of even the South. I mean, you see it in Tennessee. I mean, East Tennessee has a lot of the same grievances against Middle and Western Tennessee that Western Virginia had with Eastern Virginia.
Well, and in some cases, East Tennessee, and what was it, the Washington Association, or
right.
become a progenitor of the American Revolution. But there's no getting around the fact, Keith, that the economies of the Trans-Allegheny and the economy of the Tidewater were wildly different affairs.
Fundamentally, yeah. And it was evident early on that Western Virginia was going to have a different type of future. Well, it was even different in terms of, I mean, look at the geography. The mountains run north-south. That was something that helped to kind of divide the two sections of Virginia. The rivers that are in currently what is West Virginia generally tend to move toward the west and toward the Ohio, and so even agricultural products, I mean, the markets for those products were going to be in the west, whereas the Tidewater, you have the same rivers, the same transportation system that planters had used, since the 17th century, and they were going to continue to use.
And in point of fact, the eastern continental divide flows, emanates from the Allegheny front, does it not?
Yeah. So, I mean, right down the middle. So, in a sense, geography was definitely a factor there. I don't think that alone brought about the situation in which you'd have a new state. I mean, obviously, the Civil War, secession crisis in the Civil War, brings a unique set of circumstances, to say the least. But there were a lot of things that were kind of dividing Eastern and Western Virginia.
Well, let me ask you this question, Keith, and it's as much an economic one as anything else. Was West Virginia born poor?
I don't I don't know if that, if that's a good way of kind of putting it. I think that if you're thinking about the image of West Virginia as a place for poor people, you certainly have an image for Western Virginia even in the frontier period. For example, I'd say a good source on this is Doddridge's Notes. I don't know if you're familiar with that source. I imagine you are. And it's one that you can even get, any of your listeners can get on archive.org. I mean, you get it for free. And he talks about, you know, the social practices, the religious practices, and the way that people would dress. And there was the perception, I guess you might say, in the eastern part of Virginia, that people in the West, in the frontier period even down, were near savages. It's a lot of times what you kind of get out of the sources.
Savages being a fluid term, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, what it is you had to basically utilize some native ways and some native methods of dress, native methods of agriculture, native methods of hunting, native methods of warfare. All these things manifest themselves, obviously, in the mountainous region. And so that did kind of lead to kind of a perception of West Virginia in that sense. That's something that's been perpetuated, I think, the late 19th century, the earlier of the state. The national media approached West Virginia in a particular way. The Hatfield-McCoy feud certainly enhanced that. And even into the 20th century, even recently, you know, you can see that, you know, that there is a perception of West Virginians as poor. Are they poor? Is there a problem with poverty in West Virginia? Certainly. How did that come about? To some degree, West Virginia has never lacked wealth. It's never lacked, mineral resources. It's never lacked any of the necessities of wealth. It's just how that those mineral resources were developed.
And allocated.
And allocated, and how that took place. And that is connected to the actual process of statehood. I mean, one of the things that I think the statehood makers really were interested in is we have to create this new state. If we do not, and the war ends, and we end up back in Virginia, Virginia is not going to want to implement policies that are going to develop those resources. They don't want to pay additional taxes in order to have those kinds of resources. So we need to get away from them. And you can see that, for example, especially in the writings of Waitman T. Willie, who's one of the key players in terms of statehood making. I mean, he really kind of sees this situation as something in which, you know, if we get away, we can actually implement policies that are necessary. We can never have, he says in presenting the statehood bill, we can never have, Western Virginia can never have any kind of commerce, anything with Eastern Virginia. Economically, we are so different. We have a whole different agenda. And a lot of that came down to the idea of political power and allocation. I mean, who's going to control the state legislature? Who's going to develop internal improvement policy?
And at that point in time, Keith, the debate was, because we're so used to talking about West Virginia and coal in the same sentence, at that point in time, infrastructure development in 1865, 1863 really, was not about coal. I mean, there were salt sands that were being exploited to a certain extent, but the timber, for instance, was a bigger concern, was it not?
Yeah, timber really was the first. Of course, you had to get railroads in, or that could never take place. But the point is going to be what will the leaders of the new state have to do in order to get the capital to develop those resources, and the policies that they develop, you know, are policies designed to attract investment. Those policies are like low taxation, laws without, laws that do not inhibit business. You know, the same kind of things we're still to hear about. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me that you can read like the inaugural address of a governor like Henry Matthews in the 1870s, and it reads so much like what I've heard from Wise or from Manchin, or it's the same kind of thing. We have to attract investment. We have to have a favorable climate for investment. It's the same basic mindset.
Was there ever, do you think, Keith, an alternative to that, to turning inward and saying, let's do this ourselves as opposed to bringing in investment money from London or New York or Amsterdam?
Well, I'd say there probably was an alternative. Exactly what it is, I'm not sure, because they didn't really give it a shot. I mean, you also have to remember that the people who made the policy, I think, intrinsically benefited from it. And so if you look at governors, just governors of the state of West Virginia, especially after Reconstruction, especially after you know, all the issues of the Civil War are over and you allow former Confederates to vote and all that, essentially they all are involved. They're, it's not like we can say government is separate from business. They all essentially are investors as well as governmental leaders. And so, you know, their policies are extremely pro-business because, to a degree, they themselves are business. And by the same token, their policies are also extremely anti-labor in terms of union labor in particular. And that's really not something that should be too surprising to us. I mean, if you look at American history generally, there's quite a bit of labor turmoil in the late 19th century. And one thing that capital could always rely upon was that government, be it federal or state government, would come down on the side of capital management, not on the side of labor.
And we're sort of blowing along through the state's history.
Yeah. But we haven't talked about the process of statehood at all, have we?
Exactly. But yeah. To touch on that really quickly, West Virginia, in fact, becomes a laboratory of sorts for just how repressive government can be toward working people, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does in many ways become a worst-case scenario, and that's the Bourbon era. I mean, the Bourbon governors, you know, who are so extremely pro-business, they do not consider anything really, I think, except for how to develop those resources and how to bring in an investment. And so their assumption is, but I think it was the assumption of the statehood makers to a degree, that West Virginia did not have the indigenous capital to be able to develop those resources. I mean, the wealth here.
And as you noted, we will never know what West Virginia could have done because West
right.
Virginia was never given a chance.
No, the policy was born, you know, in a sense, with statehood, well, or shortly after statehood. I mean, statehood and the years immediately following statehood in the late 1860s or early 1870s, there's a tremendous amount of turmoil in West Virginia. West Virginia is, I think, the most divided place in the entire country when it comes to the Civil War.
Well, it's funny because there are places you would, places and cultural things that you would never even dream of. But, for instance, in one of the more western counties of this state, one that's just a county away from the Ohio River, as a matter of fact, the county itself was divided oddly. In that the southern part of the county supported the Union and the northern part of the county supported the Confederacy.
Sure.
And to this day, when you go to bury your dead, you make your choice of funeral home
right.
based upon distinctions that were created with the Civil War.
Right, yeah.
And with statehood.
Well, I mean, I've always felt like I'm someone interested in history. Many historians are people who like to go to cemeteries. You learn a lot about a community in a cemetery, and like in the Kanawha Valley, on the eastern end, you have Confederate soldiers. On the western end, you have Union soldiers. In Lewisburg and Union in Hinton, you have a monument for, you know, Confederate veterans that's been there forever and a day, it seems like. And then in places like Ripley and Parkersburg, or
there's a statue to the Grand Army of the Potomac.
Exactly, and so it's heavily divided. Now, one of the things I think that many writers, especially people who were involved in the statehood process in the decades after the war did, was they underestimated the number of people from what is now West Virginia that actually support the Confederacy and actually serve the Confederacy militarily. It was very evenly divided. And that had a lot of implications, had a lot of political implications, too.
To what extent in the modern era do you think, and this is just anecdotal or maybe wishful guessing on my part, but it seems to me that this state probably has a higher population than most states of people whose families have remained here through the generations.
Right.
Whose families, like mine, for instance, predate not only statehood but nationhood.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
What does that do to the cultural mindset of a place?
Well, I think that, you know, like, well, who's it? I don't want to. Maybe I shouldn't quote him, but you know, Marx said, you know, like the past weighs like the Alps upon the minds of the present. I think it does have an impact. Maybe it's not something that's exactly tangible, but the idea, especially in a community that you know, you stretch back so many generations, it's something. In a way, there's a lot of positives to that too, though, Bob. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good things about living in a community in which, you know, your ancestors, you know who your ancestors were, and you know what your ancestors did and who everyone else's ancestors were. But, you know, it also makes it you resistant, obviously, to certain changes. That's a hard question to really kind of put a finger on, I guess, in a way, because it's not always clear how much people think about their past. And I think especially here, like on West Virginia Day, I'm convinced that most West Virginians really do not know how West Virginia became a state. And if we went out and asked, you know, about the process, I don't believe that many would give us anything close to an accurate answer. And the reason I say that is you can teach, I can teach a college-level history course and have a bunch of people who were born and grown up in West Virginia and supposedly took a West Virginia history in, like, the eighth grade. And when I tell them the process, you know, they can't believe it. They can't believe that's really how it happened. That it's, even as, I guess you might say, convoluted as it is something that really, really strikes them, and they have a hard time getting around that. And so, I mean, West Virginia's got a legacy, and I think does have things certainly to be proud of, but it's got a legacy that's very complicated, and a legacy that's, especially in terms of the Civil War in that era, that's not simple.
Is that not just for people inside West Virginia, Keith, but for outside West Virginia?
Yeah.
Is that why this place is so easy to dismiss for people who are outside and unfamiliar with the state?
Yeah, I think so. And then, of course, the way that it's often been portrayed in the national media, you know, we've always struggled with that. We're not the only state that does. I mean, Kentucky has, and Arkansas, and many others as well, but. You know, I think it does have something to do with it. I mean, there's something unusual about, you know, how West Virginia came about.
You know, it's funny, and I was in Washington, D.C. for a couple of weeks recently, and many of the city buses are festooned with ads that say, visit West Virginia. No, really, West Virginia.
Yeah, really, West Virginia.
Not quite that, but right, close
right.
enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even like, you know, my wife's people were from West Virginia and then moved to Ohio. But, you know, like her brothers and sisters, they all grew up in Ohio. And, you know, he has one sister who's lived in Chicago and Atlanta and Boston and all over. And, you know, she'll come here and I'll take her some places and she can't believe. I mean, her image of West Virginia is not, you know, the Castaic Railroad in Pocahontas County, you know, and all that beautiful scenery and things like that. I mean, there are a lot of really, really special places in this state, and there's a lot of things in this state that people are just not, that even people in the state are not aware of. I mean, we have a good, solid symphony orchestra, but that's not something that people associate with the state.
No, but and frankly, if you tell someone from New York or California that we have a symphony, they'll ask whether the symphony plays washtubs.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, washtub basses and washboard percussion instruments, and sometimes that's about halfway cute, but sometimes it gets a little bit annoying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But we also play up to this sometimes too. I mean.
Oh, sure, we do. We are the
like the Roadkill Festival in Pocahontas County, for example.
Yeah, there's that. And what I was thinking about, twin sons of different impulses, I can think of two T-shirts, you know, T-shirt and bumper sticker culture
right.
that says a lot about a place.
Yeah, yeah.
On the one hand, I remember when then-Governor Manchin got into one of his famous dithers about Abercrombie and Fitch selling a T-shirt that said, right. West Virginia, it's all relative.
Mm-hmm.
And... then he was
that in the wake of Dick Cheney's comment? I think it might have been.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was, as a matter of fact. And then, of course, there was the joke during the O.J. trial era that O.J. was going to move to West Virginia because all our DNA was the same.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, by then Senator Manchin couldn't quite find himself, muster up the same amount of dudgeon, or the same height of dudgeon, I suppose. We measure dudgeon by height, don't we? When the coal industry's lawyers said that we have birth defect problems in mountaintop removal communities because West Virginians can't help having sex inside their own families.
Despite the fact that, you know, there's studies that show that's
no higher here than anywhere else.
Yeah, and the studies that show that, you know, mountaintop removal is not exactly healthy for a community.
Precisely. But then
peer-reviewed studies, evidently.
Yeah, exactly. In excess of 20 of them.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time with them, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I figured you did, so I knew you were familiar with that.
But then conversely, so that's outside of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, I can go 3 miles to the gift shop of a whitewater rafting company, and I can buy a T-shirt that says, "Paddle faster, I hear banjo music."
Yeah.
When, in point of fact, the reference that's making, which is, of course, to Deliverance, is about North Georgia.
Yeah.
But still, you know, when you've come up here to wild, wonderful West Virginia and you've drank you some beer and you've gone down the river and you've listened to some bluegrass, you feel like you've had an authentic hillbilly experience, and you go back home to civilization and you take your friends a T-shirt that says, "Paddle faster, I hear banjo music." Because,
yeah,
you know, you went to West Virginia and survived.
Do you think it's, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think it's interesting, in a sense, how we're kind of promoting the 150th anniversary? That's, you know, something that I think that they had more going on than I thought they would, even in, like, Charleston. I felt a little left out. Okay? And that's one of the reasons I called up, because I didn't feel like anybody really, had any interest in anything I had to say about statehood process. I was actually asked to review a script for a documentary, and I don't know if what I said was actually is actually well received, because I mean there is the interpretation, and you can make the case that West Virginia and the statehood process was unconstitutional; it was illegal.
You absolutely can, and I think we should probably go into that.
Well, I mean, I think it was former governor of Virginia Wise, Henry Wise, who's also a Confederate general, who said that, you know, West Virginia was a bastard offspring of political rape. There is that viewpoint, and it's funny, when I lay this process out and I ask students, you know, was it constitutional or was it not, and that's going to be the essay. I mean, you're going to write on that, you know, are you going to make a case for it being constitutional, or are you going to make a case for it being illegal? It is an academic question to us. But it was not an academic question to people back in the 1860s at all.
No, it was existential, wasn't it?
It was very important, indeed. It was almost life and death. You know, of course, if the Confederacy prevails and there's no West Virginia state, you know, those people who try to create a new state, if they fail, they're either going to be somewhere else or they're going to be executed for treason. Yeah, so treason against Virginia. So it's definitely an important question. For them, not an academic question at all. And I think, of course, when you think about the process of statehood, it all boiled down to, of course, Article 4, Section 3 of the United States Constitution. I mean, you can create a new state from an existing state. And I know you know this. You've studied enough law to know this. And in fact, there are some instances of when Maine came in as a...
Right, that was the first thing I was going to say, was Maine.
Yeah, Massachusetts, of course, the legislature had to approve that. And so what the statehood makers had to do was they had to get Virginia's approval to create a new state. And so, you know, in essence, they created a recreated Virginia so that they could give themselves permission to create a new state. And that's it. It's
yeah, they basically
thing.
Created a Virginia legislature in exile.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they had several members. I mean, if we kind of move back a little bit, Virginia's secession convention was meeting in Richmond, even before Fort Sumter, and in fact had already had several preliminary votes, and secession was not winning. I mean, secession was behind. After Fort Sumter and Lincoln calls for volunteers to put down a rebellion, of course, you know, Virginia moves more and more towards secession. And at that convention, if you look at it at that convention in Richmond, and by the way, the University of Richmond, has a great website in which you can look at all of the documents concerning that secession convention, and you can even look at the speeches by the delegates by county. And so you can find out, you know, delegates from whatever county, what their viewpoint was. I think at the University of Richmond has that site, and it's filled with all kinds of primary source material, you know, associated with that convention. But when you look at how people who were from counties that would be, in West Virginia, actually voted at that convention, the secession was approved at that convention 88-55. And would be, of course, submitted to the voters for ratification on May 23rd, 1861. But there were 47 delegates from current West Virginia, and 32 voted against secession. So 32 were Unionists and did not want to leave.
And in large part because they were economically tied to,
yeah.
I mean, the biggest city in the region was Wheeling, was it not?
Yeah, and they're in the northern panhandle between Pennsylvania and Ohio. Economically, they're dependent on that area, so that's not surprising. 11 actually voted for secession, and 4 abstained. Now, when you start to look at the ratification, I will point out, you know, you realize that Virginia, Confederate Virginia, you know, well, actually, it's not Confederate Virginia yet. It hasn't really technically seceded. Virginia starts seizing federal installations even before ratification. Harper's Ferry is seized before ratification. You know, something that doesn't set well, obviously, with Unionists in Western Virginia. But when you look,
it feels a little like war, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels like war, smells like war, it must be war, and definitely preparing for war. When you look at ratification, however, what you see is that a surprising number of counties that end up in West Virginia actually ratify secession. And some of them actually ratify secession in a dramatic fashion, especially in the southern part of the state. That's true of like Greenbrier, Monroe, Mercer, McDowell.
Interestingly enough, places that had a higher concentration of slaves than anywhere else that would become West Virginia.
Certainly. Even though, you know, Kanawha Valley was, you know, certainly had some plantation economy, narrowly defeated the secession ordinance. Raleigh County approved it, but there was, you know, significant resistance to it. There are some of the counties in the eastern panhandle. Jefferson County ratified the secession ordinance. But a large number of counties, and that's something that, you know, one of the things I do in a classroom setting is I bring in these statistics, these ratification statistics, and I give them a blank map. And I tell them the day before, and college students are, you know, always like, what do you mean? I tell them, bring crayons or something. So let's represent this on a map, right? And so let's look at the statistics. What can we learn about the situation? And so they color the map, and they see how many counties actually ratify secession. And, of course, my question is, you know, why is Monroe County in West Virginia? It makes no sense. I mean, why is Greenbrier County in West Virginia? I mean, when 91% of the military-age male population are going to serve in the Confederate Army, and they're going to be represented in the Confederate Virginia legislature throughout the war. How'd they end up in the state of West Virginia? You know, why is that the case? And, you know, I usually get a lot of blank looks. You know, don't know why. Well, you have to look at the process. The Unionists in the northern part of what would be West Virginia are going to control that process. And they are going to be the ones who are going to basically put that process in place. If you look at the Wheeling Convention, the first Wheeling Convention, which meets in May before ratification, that first Wheeling Convention had like 436 members who are, you know, just to be generous here, basically selected by very creative processes. I mean, essentially, if you show up and you say, I'm from Lewis County, you know, you can actually sit. You know, there's no real process of selection. 162.
If you're safe, you're in.
Yeah, if you're safe, you're in. 162 of the 436 actually from the northern panhandle, and only one county south of the canal was ever even there, and that was Wayne County. And then the second Wheeling Convention, at the first Wheeling Convention, there's an attempt to actually create a state immediately. And a key figure there is John Carlisle, of Harrison County, and he wants to create a state called New Virginia, and just immediately create it. And New Virginia would be much, much smaller than the current state of West Virginia, and it would include none of the counties that ratified, that eventually would ratify secession. It wouldn't include any of the Eastern Panhandle either.
Wow.
And that was his proposal. I mean, it would basically be the Northern Panhandle, the north central part, was now West Virginia.
But meanwhile,
down to about Clay County.
Meanwhile, even as basically north of the Little Kanawha and,
right.
and the Elk River.
Exactly. But, yeah. Yeah.
Meanwhile, though, back in Washington, President Lincoln, who it was nothing if not a pragmatic man above all things.
Pretty much, yeah.
Even after Virginia passed its ordinance of secession, and knowing full well that there was a statehood movement underway across the Trans-Allegheny, still was not really on board, was he?
It's difficult, especially, and that's part of the problem at the first Wheeling Convention. If Carlisle gets his way, Carlisle wants to form a state now. Now, Carlisle is not ignorant of the Constitution, but of course, he doesn't believe that Virginia will ever give them permission once secession takes place, and then they'll be, you know, left hanging. And so he wants to go ahead and strike where the iron's hot. He's going to be, of course, defeated by Borman and Pierpont and many of these others, because their contention is that the federal government will never go along with this. You're going to fight a war against secession, but really what Carlisle's talking about is seceding from Virginia. I mean, what's the basis of it? I mean, it doesn't fulfill Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution. And so they're not going to go through that process. And so what they essentially do is they're going to, of course, they prepare an address to discourage, you know, the secessionists, to kind of encourage the defeat of the ordinance, of the, you know, secession ordinance. They agree to have a second convention, to have delegates for a second convention also meeting in Wheeling in June. And so sometimes like first Wheeling convention is called the May convention because it met in May. The second one's called the June convention because it met in June. And so, you know, they adjourn May 23rd, secession is ratified. Even by many of the counties, they're going to end up in West Virginia. And to me, that's one of the more fascinating twists. I mean, was Virginia divided? Yes. But not only was Virginia divided, but what would be West Virginia was heavily divided. And this really complicates it, muddies the process, and muddies the waters considerably for us here.
In a way, though, because the process itself was manipulated towards statehood, I think that's a fair statement.
Mm-hmm.
It resembles the Constitutional Convention of the United States, does it not?
It sure does. And you can make the case that the Constitutional Convention had no real legal standing, that is doing something against the Articles that was essentially illegal. You could also say the same, obviously, of the Confederate Constitutional Convention in Montgomery, you know, that just met and drafted the Confederate Constitution. You know, you could certainly say that. And so some of these things, you know, to a degree, what's going to make the difference here is obviously going to be military events. You know, West Virginia statehood and the statehood makers and the statehood movement, you know, benefited from a favorable military situation. The Confederacy did very poorly in northwestern Virginia in 1861 after they defeated Philippines.
Well, I happen to live on that chunk of U.S. 60,
right,
where General, former Governor Wise, and General Governor
Floyd. Hey,
Floyd.
Yeah. Terrible. They're terrible. I mean,
and it's a delightful story all by itself. Because those two people were so busy fighting each other that they really had no time to fight the Union forces.
And neither one also really knew anything about generalship. They were political appointees. Davis receives letters from prominent citizens who are secessionists, including Mason Matthews of Greenbrier County. He's an interesting guy. He'll sit in the Virginia legislature throughout the war representing Greenbrier County. He had two sons in the Confederate Army, and he wrote a letter to Jefferson Davis, and essentially in the letter, he's like, you know, these two men would not be happy until, you know, they've destroyed one another, right? They hate each other so much. You know, we want a military general. And Davis does send Lee with orders to coordinate. But essentially Wise has given up the Kanawha Valley really without much of a fight.
And Lee takes one look at the ground and says, what are you people, crazy?
Yeah, yeah. And this is, I mean,
you can't fight a war here.
Yeah, the war in Western Virginia is very, very difficult. The logistics are horrible. Between you have objectives on each end of the, like the New River Valley. You know, on the north end you have the Salines and the Kanawha Valley, and obviously saltpeter necessary for making gunpowder and all that. On the south end in what is now southwestern Virginia, you have the Virginia-Tennessee Railroad, and of course a crucial railroad bridge at Radford. You have a lead works at Wytheville that will manufacture a third of all of the cartridges manufactured in the Confederacy.
Is that the old shot tower you can see from the highway?
I don't know if that's it, but I know it was down there. And Dave Barge done some work on this. I know you know him. He taught at Concord for a long time. And then you had the salt works at Saltville.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how, because West Virginia, I've often joked that West Virginia is the only state in the Union that forms an obscene gesture.
That's true. Right.
Has a rather unique shape.
Oh, yeah, extremely unique.
The western part of it is, of course, defined by the Ohio River, and that at least makes some degree of sense.
Right. The northern part of the eastern panhandle is the Potomac.
Right, and then you've got the chunk of it that's the Mason-Dixon line, Preston and Monongalia counties.
Somebody was asking me about that today, in fact, and the gentleman was from Pennsylvania, and you know, why is you have such a narrow line with that panhandle? And, of course, part of the answer there is that in the colonial period, both Virginia and Pennsylvania claimed the western part of what is now Pennsylvania, and in particular Pittsburgh, the forks of the Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia actually controlled, you know, Fort Pitt, you know, after the French and Indian War.
Right.
You know, Pennsylvania did not. So there was a lot of dispute. There were people, in fact, you know, in the frontier era who lived in the northern part of what is now West Virginia and in the northern panhandle who were not sure which colony and then which state they lived in for a while. You know, who really, and so essentially authority was all local. So that is, you know, a survey line. But that southern border, of course, you have the, you know, the sandy, you know, but the southern border is kind of, you know, kind of curious, right? I mean, what's the difference between Monroe County and Giles County? Monroe County, West Virginia, Giles County.
Oh, and all along the eastern border there, what's the difference between Pendleton County and Highlands County, Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I would contend that also in terms of sentiment during the war, there's almost no difference. That they're essentially the same place.
But was there not a referendum? I mean, when statehood finally began to coalesce, was there not a county by county referendum?
There was theoretically, I guess you might say. And of course, the Second Wheeling Convention meets in June, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of go back to that. The Second Wheeling Convention meets in June. They draft an interesting little document that, you know, your listeners would have no trouble finding, called the Declaration of the People of Virginia, in which they're, of course, you know, proclaiming their loyalty, obviously, to the Union. They also are stating that all those who had adhered to the ordinance, to secession, who were in state government, that their offices were void. So, in other words, John Letcher is not truly the governor of Virginia, because he's a traitor. You know, from their point of view, he's a traitor. And he's, you know, a secessionist. And so he's not truly the governor of Virginia. His office is void. And all those members of the state legislature who had voted for secession and fought for secession, they are no longer truly members of the government of Virginia. And so what they're doing is they're creating the reorganized government of Virginia. And so you have there in Wheeling members of the Virginia legislature before secession. And the idea is that they are going to be the legislature of Virginia. So basically reorganizing Virginia in order to give themselves permission to form a new state, which will fulfill...
Isn't that neat how that works?
Yeah, it will fulfill Article 4, Section 3 if they do it that way, right?
Right.
So, you know, the Second Wheeling Convention does that. And, of course, they elect a provisional governor of Virginia, and that is Francis Pierpont. So he was in the... who's sometimes called the father of West Virginia. He is not the governor of West Virginia. He's the governor of reorganized Virginia, loyal Virginia.
Yes.
And that government's purpose is to give themselves permission to form a new state. And they do something else that I think is very important and often gets looked over in this whole process, and even in textbooks. In fact, the famous history of West Virginia written by Otis Rice, and I'm not trying to be critical of Otis Rice, because I think Otis Rice was one of the, you know, the finest things, you know, finest historians this state's ever had. But he only mentions it, you know, in one paragraph. They have a state legislature, and therefore, as you well know, senators, United States senators, were not popularly elected until the 20th century,
right?
Until the 70th Amendment. And so they can elect United States senators, and they do. They elect Waitman T. Willie of Morgantown, and they elect John Carlisle, Clarksburg, as senators for Virginia, and send them to Washington. And for me, this is maybe the most crucial moment. Because when they arrive in Washington, obviously the Congress, the United States Senate, has to vote on whether to seat them or not. There's opposition to seating them. They're going to be presented to the Senate by Andrew Johnson, who's a senator from Tennessee who did not leave. When Tennessee, of course, seceded from the Union, he stayed in the Senate. Later will be vice presidential candidate in 1864, and then president after Lincoln's assassination. He presents him to the Senate, and the delegation, the senators from Delaware, in fact, oppose their seating and debate that they should not be seated. That's not the process, not legitimate. But the vote goes 35-5, and they seat them. And I think that once you seat those two men from Virginia, the federal government and the Congress in particular is recognizing the reorganized government of Virginia as being the legitimate government of all of Virginia. And to me, that's a crucial moment. Had they not seated them, the process, I don't think it would have went much further from this.
It would have delegitimized the organization of the government in exile.
Yeah, I mean, it would have basically said, we're not going to support this. But once you've done that, and I think when you look at, when the bill finally comes before Lincoln and Lincoln presents it to his cabinet, which is vintage Lincoln, right? Work with your cabinet, get the advice of these capable men that you have basically brought together, as Doris Kearns Goodwin puts it, a team of rivals. And they divide on the issue. I mean, three of them say, you can't do this. I mean, his questions are, is it constitutional? Is it expedient? Three of them say, no, it's not constitutional. It's not expedient, including the Attorney General, Edward Bates. But Salmon P. Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, he makes the case that we've already recognized the reorganized government of Virginia. If we say no now, we are basically going back on everything that we have done, including what Congress has done by seating those two men. By seating those two senators, that's crucial. I think it's absolutely crucial. It also meant that there would be those who would be working for the process of statehood within the Senate itself, even though Carlisle eventually will turn on the statehood movement.
That portion of the story gets really weird. It is weird.
We don't know why.
It almost seems like Carlisle, I don't know that he had some sort of a breakdown or something. That's speculation, but.
Well, I think it was Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts. No, it was Benjamin Wade, senator from Ohio, who was the chairman of the Territories Committee. And Carlisle had a seat on the Territories Committee. But Wade, when Carlisle brings forth his bill that adds more counties than the dismemberment ordinance that added, basically Carlisle's bill is probably an attempt to sabotage the whole statehood process. And I think that, part of that has to do with, you could be opposed to secession and not necessarily want a new state. I mean, you could be opposed to secession. You could be a unionist but not be a new state person. You could be a new state person even then, and have your doubts, though, about how the state was being organized. And so as you look at the process, after Virginia grants its permission, they draft a dismemberment ordinance, and then you do have your referendum. But your referendum is kind of shaky. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That the dismemberment ordinance called for the creation of a new state, which would be called Kanawha, and that state would have about 39 counties, some of which were still under Confederate control. There would be additional counties that could to hold referendums in order to join at that particular time. When you look at the electorate that approves that ordinance, you had an electorate of only about 19,000 people, when there should have been, if you look at the secession ratification ordinance, the ratification of secession ordinance in May of 1861, there should have been around 48,000 voters. Of course, where are those voters? They're in the various armies.
They're busy. Yeah, they're busy committing treason. Yeah.
Some of them are in the Confederate Army, and some of them are in the Union Army. And so you have a vote of 18,408 to 781. You know, so in some like Jefferson County, for example, when they come in, when they vote to come in, there's like 300 votes. I mean, where is everybody? Everybody in Jefferson County is in the Confederate Army, is where they're at. I mean, that's why after once the war is over, they're going to, you know, West Virginia is going to have to try to use federal troops to keep them from participating in Virginia elections. Because you're going to have such, because they're not part of that process, right? They're not part of the process. And in fact, if you look at the dismemberment ordinance and you look at the statistics, 70% of the positive vote, you know, the vote to dismember the state, actually comes from the northern panhandle, you know, down to around Doddridge County, you know, over Wood County, and the very top third of what is now West Virginia. About 30% of those positive votes come from the central area down even into Raleigh County. Raleigh County does participate. There are no returns from, you know, many of the more ardently secessionist counties, such as especially Greenbrier, Fayette, Mercer, Monroe, what is now Summers.
Yeah, I was living in a hotbed of
Wyoming.
My family was living in a hotbed of treason. Yes.
Yeah, essentially. Well, you know, my wife's people were from from West Virginia originally, and then moved to Ohio. She's a descendant of Henry Haynes, who's in the 44th Virginia. And of course, I'm a descendant of Confederate soldiers too. So I mean, that's not an uncommon thing in southern West Virginia.
And it's even not uncommon to have some Confederate and some going Union.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at the ratification of secession ordinance in 1861, Clay County is evenly divided. I mean, down to the man. You have the same number of people voting for as vote against. And, I mean, you want to talk about divided. I mean, so there are instances, for example, like at Droop Mountain in November of 1863, a father fighting for the Confederacy was captured by a son fighting for the Union. You want to talk about brother against brother, West Virginia is the place where that can really happen.
You know, it's
probably another place.
The echoes down through the generations are fascinating. My great grandmother and great grandfather, presumably, I guess they collaborated on this. For some reason, every one of her children, male children, and there were a lot of them, were named with a name beginning with the letter L.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea why. But, for instance, my great grandfather was LaViggy Lawrence Kincaid.
Wow.
But this is where I kind of wonder what was going on. She names, and this is post-Civil War, she names one of her sons Loammy, which is a name out of the Bible, I believe.
Right, yeah.
But his middle name is Imboden.
Oh, after the Confederate general.
We know our family history fairly closely. And there's no connection to the Imboden family whatsoever.
So no one in your family fought in under his command.
That much I do not know. But
it can get really complicated because a lot of them switch regiments, and of course, more and more territory falls under Union arms, and more deserted. It's interesting. It's like, for example, when I was at Virginia Tech, I would do research for families in the Confederate service record. Especially if they were trying to get a headstone, you know, a new headstone for like one of their Civil War ancestors. And sometimes I'd end up, you know, kind of bursting balloons. It was kind of unpleasant to do that. One family had this story that their great great grandfather was wounded in battle and lost an arm, and that their great-great-grandmother took this long trip in a wagon in order to pick him up and bring him back home.
That's Cold Mountain, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a lot very similar. Of course, this is long before that movie came out.
Right.
But I found out that, he was wounded. He was wounded at Cloyd's Mountain in 1864. He did lose an arm. He's not very far from where I live, in fact. But, you know, their story was that Stonewall Jackson gave him over. Well, Cloyd's Mountain fought in 1864. Jackson had been dead for a year. So,
right, exactly.
So when I found out that he was wounded, where he was wounded and everything, and so I have to kind of say, well, no, that can't be true. That's not pleasant to see, you know, the reaction sometimes you get, from families like that. So I only did a couple of those after that, and so I kind of stopped, you know, stopped doing that little research and the service record on the side because I found things people didn't want to know.
Well, my family history is kind of strange because, and of course you've got all, like any family, you've got all kinds of different family names. But it seems like most of the folk, well, for instance, the man who would go on to become my great grandfather, Goad, is born in 1865.
Oh, okay.
So that leaves in Carroll County, Virginia.
Okay, yeah.
And you know that's right there on the North Carolina border. And I have to wonder. Well, all these little things, and it'd be fun to research. But you know, was his dad involved in the Civil War?
Well,
if so, then how does he come into being in, you know, 1865?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
When dear old multi-great-granddad, would, if he was in the war, would have been marching around somewhere.
Yeah, might have had to leave. I don't know. It's possible, but...
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating stuff out there. Let me ask you this question, because I don't know, I flat out don't know the answer to it. You were talking about some of the inconsistencies that come into play with the creation of the state of West Virginia, Keith. Obviously, Abraham Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863.
That's very important.
And that would, therefore, at that point in time, free all the slaves in what was then the western part of Virginia.
No, certain counties are exempted.
No?
Certain counties are exempted. Let's see if I'm in my office, so I might be able to find the document and tell you for sure, but certain counties in Virginia were exempted, and some of them were those counties that actually are involved in this process. And so, okay, what I've
so
got,
like Greenbrier and Monroe?
Those counties would not be exempted. Now, those counties, Greenbrier County, they're in the Confederacy, and that's the way they approach it.
So I get so my question is, if there are slaveholders in western Virginia on January 1st, 1863, who, by theoretical operation of the Emancipation Proclamation, their slaves are freed, what happens when they become part of Virginia, or when they become West Virginia and part of the Union, or a border state, because, for instance, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free slaves in Kentucky, or Missouri, or Maryland?
It did not free slaves in the northern part of West Virginia. There are counties that are exempted. And so, I mean, again, you know, West Virginia is going to try to come into the Union as a slave state. And let me see if I can look up the text of the Emancipation Proclamation. That'd help us out, because I've got this really slow laptop here in my office. But, of course, you know, after dismemberment ordinance, right, after that was ratified, and you got to remember, when I'm talking about these statistics and voting and things of that nature, people vote at this time by voice. You don't have the Australian ballot, so everybody knows how you vote. That's true for, you know, both for the secession ordinance, and that's true here for the dismemberment ordinance, which always always brings me some questions concerning you know, some of these statistics. For example, in Henry County, Virginia, right there on the North Carolina border, you're talking about Carroll, one person votes against secession. You know, what was that? Was that a joke? was that one person with an incredible amount of guts? I mean, what was going on?
Dear old multi-great-granddad. No.
Yeah, you know, you got to wonder about that. Okay, here we go. There are exceptions in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation. If you look at the not the preliminary, but the actual document of January 1st, 1863, and it says that slaves are freed in Virginia, except the 48 counties designated as West Virginia, who are going to be, you know, the 39 plus the additional ones in the dismemberment ordinance that, of course, had been adopted there in 1862. So those counties that are going to end up in the state, they're not covered by the Emancipation Proclamation, so slavery still exists. And that is important because the next step in the process was a Constitution Convention. And so West Virginia had to draft the state constitution, and they did that in Wheeling. And this is the same people who are doing this, the whole process, essentially. And that convention meets from about November 1861 to February of 1862, and they do some things that are kind of surprising. The original constitution for the state of West Virginia provided for township government. Local government would be township government, which is along the northern model.
Yeah, the Pennsylvania style.
Yeah, yeah. And so they would have township government. Now, obviously, we don't live under this constitution because we don't have township government, right? And that, to me, that's a big part of the story as well. They had universal white man-made suffrage. They didn't have any property qualifications. That's been one of the things they didn't like about Virginia. Virginia didn't drop those until the 1850s. They were going to have popular election of the governor. Virginia didn't do that until the 1850s. They were going to apportion the state legislature on the basis of only the free population, only the white population. But what is most important, I mean, they debated about counties. There were some who wanted to take every county all the way down the Tennessee line. If they did that, that would add probably 50,000 additional 50,000 additional slaves to the state. And given the mood of the Lincoln administration, that wasn't exactly a good option. It also would have required West Virginia to assume more of Virginia's state debt. The state constitution provided that West Virginia would assume a portion of the state debt.
And see, that's,
they don't
that's,
say how much.
That's and that's part of the question, going back to the early part of our conversation, Keith.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of the reason for my question, was West Virginia born poor?
Okay.
Because we did take on Virginia debt.
Yeah, but we voided it. And in fact, one of the things the Bourbon governors do throughout the 1870s and 1880s is they constantly refer to this to a committee. They're always studying it. And there's one state senator who would contend year after year in the 1880s that actually Virginia owed West Virginia money. But they avoid paying that debt. In fact, that issue is not resolved until the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, resolves that issue between West Virginia and Virginia in 1915. I think I have the statistic here somewhere. Oh, here it is. In fact, the Supreme Court held that West Virginia owed Virginia $12,393,929.50, which West Virginia finally pays off in 1939.
Good God.
They pay payments and pay it off in 1939. But, you know, they have for a couple of generations, West Virginia doesn't go out of their way to pay that debt, to even define that debt. I mean, it's very unpopular to stand up on a stump or at a railroad platform in the early 1880s and say, well, we need to honor our debt with Virginia and we need to pay that. And so they don't do it. They avoid doing it.
Wow.
But I think what's most interesting about that Constitutional Convention is not really what they do, but what they don't do. The other thing they do not do, other than define what debt they should pay, is they do not abolish slavery. And so that Constitution, you know, did not abolish slavery. They were going to try to enter the Union as a slave state. And since their slaves are exempted under the Emancipation Proclamation, they could do that. And that turns out to be a stickler when it comes to Congress. Because you realize the Congress, you know, the Southern senators are gone,
right?
And so it's not going to be possible to get Congress to approve, a new state that's a slave state.
No, not with the radical abolitionists.
Certainly, and the war's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, Lincoln early on was very acted very genderly when it came to the
ambivalent, maybe
to the institution of slavery, because he was concerned about border areas, he's concerned about these counties in Western Virginia, he's concerned about Kentucky, he's concerned about Missouri.
Well, he's desperate to hang on to Kentucky.
Yeah, he said, you know, he'd like to have God on his side, but he must have Kentucky. All right, he had to have Kentucky, and so, you know, holding on to these border areas, making sure that you encourage people in Eastern Tennessee, Western North Carolina, to resist the Confederacy.
You know what, Keith? Just this whole conversation reminds me that you and I could probably sit down and do an entire series of and just look at the shift in politics based on geography. I mean, isn't it so interesting, for instance, that while Tennessee is considered a red state now,
yeah,
the blood red part of Tennessee is East Tennessee.
Yeah, which was Unionist.
Which was Unionist and liberalish at the time. Whereas
West Virginia, I mean, you know, West Virginia's, you know, the presidential elections, last several presidential elections, and in last presidential election, you know, Obama did not win a single county in West Virginia.
No. Right. The United Mine Workers, which had a long history of supporting Democratic presidential candidates this past election cycle, couldn't quite find it in themselves to endorse Barack Obama. And that was, even in the present political climate, that was just shocking.
And then what kind of surprising to me there is that, is you look at Virginia and how Virginia is changing.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, Obama did very well in Northern Virginia, Richmond, Hampton areas, but it did not do nearly as well in Southwestern Virginia. Southwestern Virginia votes like Southern West Virginia.
A lot of that had to do with the propaganda campaign run by the coal industry.
Frankly. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I'm over here in Beckley. There was a sign. A colleague of mine commented on all.
Oh, the Obama No Job Zone.
No Job Zone. Right. Yeah. The No Job Zone.
Even though coal jobs went up during.
Yeah.
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 Let it be said that the coal industry is willing to allow itself to be swayed by fads.
Yeah. I guess you can make your own facts if you have the money to put up the billboards.
I told you I'd only keep you for an hour or so, and I don't want to make you late getting home or anything. But let's just spend a few minutes running West Virginia into the future a little bit and talk about the rise of extractive industries, if we could.
Okay, I think that's important. Of course, you know, after you do get congressional approval, and you only get it because you're going to, of course, provide for eventual emancipation. The Willie Amendment does that. And, of course, once the 13th Amendment comes along, that's all irrelevant. But I think that, you know, when the process is over and Lincoln has signed the bill and the new state is in place, how to develop those resources is certainly an important factor. But you have so much turmoil at the end of the war. And you can see that in the state of the annual addresses, the state of the state addresses of Borman, Arthur Borman, the first governor, in 1865, 66, 67, and 68. There's a running theme in which he talks about how difficult it is to collect taxes in some counties, how federal troops are going to be necessary to basically enforce West Virginia's authority in Jefferson County, Berkeley County, Monroe County. I mean, Union is such a tiny little town and such a pleasant, beautiful town, and any of your listeners who are in the area who haven't been there, you should go there, right? Because, I mean, it's just as quaint and as pretty a little place as you're ever going to see. It was in turmoil. There had to be Union troops there, federal troops there for nearly 2 years to maintain order. And so all of this was not conducive to gaining, investment. And so I think that, one of the things that crucial was in 1868, William Stevenson of Parkersburg was elected governor, and he's going to change policy. I mean, what Borman and the statehood makers did after the war was they tried to essentially disenfranchise those who had served the Confederacy. For example, voter registration laws, tests of things like that. They really thought it was absolutely necessary because in 1865, as soon as the war's over, Greenbrier County sent Henry Mason Matthews to the state Senate, and he's fresh out of the Confederate Army. And of course, the state Senate will not seat him. And they also elected, two judges. Two judges were elected in West Virginia, both of whom had served the Confederacy, one militarily and one Samuel Price, who had been lieutenant governor of Confederate Virginia. Which is kind of the same thing that's happening on the national level. I mean, Georgia, for example, in that first election, the Georgia legislature, according to Johnson's Reconstruction, actually sent Alexander Stevens to the Senate, who had been Confederate vice president. So, this idea they're not really accepting the outcome of the war, and so you're going to try to restrict them and not permit them to vote or hold office.
How about that? And 150 years later, we have a Republican Party that refuses to accept the outcome of the
election,
2012 election.
Yeah, and of course, the secessionists in 1861 refused to accept the outcome of the election of 1860.
Right.
So, I mean, I've said this, and I've said this a lot to Bill O'Brien, and I think we've even said it in the Prism chats. The Tea Party, I think there's a lot more Jefferson Davis in them than Thomas Jefferson. Right? I think that, the secessionists are very much, where that mindset.
Keith, we have a running gag here on the horn, since we are poor as Job's turkey. and broker than the Ten Commandments. We don't have anything to give away, but we award imaginary toasters.
Oh, okay.
In lieu of that, and I'm proud to say that you just got tonight's toaster. There's a lot more Jefferson Davis in the Tea Party than Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, especially if you look at, you know, some of the things that they say, they sound a lot like a lot of things that they've said. It sounds a lot like secessionists.
Well, they've got a real taste for nullification, among other things, right?
Yeah, states' rights. They talk about that.
Well, did you? I just happened to catch, and let me find this for you because I think you'll find it fascinating. I just happened to catch something. Beth down in Texas posted on my Facebook page, and it comes from a recent act of the Texas State Senate. In regard to, well, of course, it has to be either guns or abortion, right?
Right.
Let me see if I can find this. Here it is. This is a statement that was appended to the bottom of this this bill restricting abortion in ways that. Well, frankly, it's a done deal. It's going to be struck down by the courts because the whole thing is unconstitutional. So at the bottom of this piece of legislation, the Texas legislature appends the following language. The legislature further declares that it would have passed this act and each provision, section, subsection, sentence, clause, phrase, or word and all constitutional applications of this act, irrespective of the fact that any provision, section, subsection, sentence, clause, phrase, or word, or applications of this act were to be declared unconstitutional or to represent an undue burden. Hello, nullification.
Yeah, it's John C. Calhoun. So it's the same
thing. I mean, it is. That is straight. I mean, that's straight out of the vest pocket of John C. Calhoun.
Probably not worded quite as sophisticated, but yeah. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing.
So, you know, it's the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, the 150th anniversary of Brandy Station, the 150th anniversary of the statehood of West Virginia, and you can make a compelling argument that there are some things that still haven't changed very much.
Well, yeah, my friend and colleague Bill O'Brien believes that's American history. Throughout American history, we've debated about, you know, different how much authority the federal government should have opposed to the state government, you know, what really is the role of government. And you see that, obviously, in the build-up to the Civil War, you see it in the controversy of the Progressive Era, you see it in the controversy of the New Deal, and we still see it today. And I think he's right on that. And, you know, he's very eloquent when he talks about that. And those of you who've listened to the Prism Chats, you've heard him, you know, really kind of stand forth, and sometimes I'm really amazed at how much information he has in his mind about this stuff. But that's American history.
It truly is. Let's bounce back to West Virginia just really quick, like.
Yeah, we really haven't finished the story because, to me, if you just stop with 1863, that's faulty.
Yeah.
Because what happened was in 1868 with Stevenson's election, Stevenson is convinced that they have to, you know, develop these resources. They need investment, and that all the turmoil between Unionists and Confederates had to be stopped. And so he advocates a let-up policy. And of course, part of it's practical. I mean, you can disenfranchise the fathers, but you can't disenfranchise the sons. And so eventually, and the fear on the part of statehood makers, but they're Republicans. That if the Democrats get a hold of the state, that they'll undo statehood. And that turns out not to be the case. But once you have let-up policy, once you have the Flick Amendment is the amendment to the state constitution that lifts all those restrictions on Confederates, the Democrats have control of the state. I mean, they had elected already, even before that, John Jacob, who was a Democratic candidate for governor, who was actually from, I think, Romney. He was of the Eastern Panhandle, and he had the distinction of actually not being in the area during the war. He had been teaching at the University of Missouri, so he could be identified with either those who favored the Union, those who supported the Confederacy. But you have a situation where the Democrats have control. And I tell you that the faction within the Democratic Party that, you know, really, really takes the lead here are the Redeemers. They're the former Confederates. And what they do is they rewrite the state constitution. They, you know, they get a new constitutional convention, which meets in Charleston in 1872, and they draft the constitution that we live under today. We do not live under the constitution drafted in Wheeling.
No.
It's the constitution of 1872 that is the constitution of West Virginia even today. With obviously modifications. For example, for them, the governor would have 1 4-year term, could not be reelected. So every governor was a lame duck. And that would be the case, obviously, until the modern governor's amendment in the late 1960s. And so they scrapped the township system. Then they put back a county court system. And they reaffirm all of Virginia land law, and that's going to be a big part of the story in terms of extractive industries, because one of the things that, you know, companies are going to do is they're going to use the incredibly overlapping and crazy quilt pattern of land claims in West Virginia that go all the way back to the colonial period. All reaffirmed by the Virginia Land Law of 1779, now reaffirmed for West Virginia by the Constitution of 1872, which is filled with lawyers.
Right, and that in turn, does it not, Keith, facilitates the rise and nefarious use of the broad form deed?
Yeah, the broad form deed. It also
can you take a minute, and because the broad form deed may not be something with which many many members of the Horn family commune are familiar. But it has operation that people may not even know exist as to why, you know, their forebears left somewhere and wound up where they are.
Yeah, the broad form deed. I think I have a copy of one here somewhere. I wanted to kind of, you know, it's an interesting kind of document. I tell you, Ronald Lewis, who teaches out of West Virginia University, he and John C. Hennen published a volume years ago called West Virginia Documents in the History of a Rural Industrial State, and it's out of print. But if you go to his class site where he teaches West Virginia history, he has it all in PDF, every single document. And it's like 113 documents in the history of West Virginia, and he has an example of broad form deed, in fact, in that volume. I'm looking for it. On page 194.
Could I impose upon you to send me a link to that?
I can sure do that. I can sure do that.
I need that for teaching purposes here at the house.
Yeah, that's a great source, and I use it in my classes too. And that's also one way I can kind of, you know, keep students from having to buy another book. There's so much stuff available for them. Of course, you know, the state archives has all kinds of the documents in terms of statehood available, you know, that you can, of course, acquire and read on online. I mean, if you want to know this stuff, you can find it. Of course, the broad form deed uses some interesting language, to say the least. It's designed not to be comprehensible. I mean, that said, parties of the first part in consideration of the sum of dollars in cash in hand, paid, received, wherever is hereby acknowledged, the same amount being the total amount. And you can go on and read it and read it and read it. It talks a lot of times about mental rights and things of that nature.
And it is designed specifically to bamboozle an illiterate landowner.
Yeah, it's designed to confuse you. All coal, minerals, mineral substances and products, all oils and gases, all salts, salt, minerals, waters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd say something else they used was they could use, because of Virginia land law of 1779, approved preemption rights, tomahawk rights, back in the frontier era.
Yeah.
But you basically make notches in trees.
My multi-great grandfather did that.
Right. Quote unquote, improve 400 acres and claim it. You could transfer that because under Virginia land law and under the Constitution of 1872, you could transfer that. You could also transfer land warrants issued even back in the colonial era. So, you know, if great, 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 great granddad or whatever went to war against the Shawnee in Dunmore's War of 1774 and was granted land as a result because he served as an officer in Lewis's army, you can transfer that. Now, of course, the frontier period complicates this because you have shifting population. You know, people come into the Greenbrier Valley. They're attacked by the Shawnee. They get scared. They leave, right? They don't come back, but they still have a claim, in a sense. And so someone can acquire, a speculator can acquire that claim and use it against someone who's already on the land. And so some of these things pop up again in the late 19th century. And you can be working, you can be on your land, and a company can show up and they have Revolutionary War warrants. And they claim, if they can get a judge to approve their claim, they can basically evict you from your own land, which, you know, they can use at the very least as pressure to get you to sell them their mineral rights, sell them mineral rights. What does that mean? And so when you look at the end of Reconstruction in West Virginia, you see the beginning of an era of political figures who basically are wanting to make sure that the policies are favorable for those companies coming in. And those are the Bourbons. And the first one of those is Henry Mason Matthews of Greenbrier County. Who runs in 1876. He's a former Confederate officer. He was an ordnance officer in Stevenson's division of the Army of Tennessee. And he runs against Nathan Goff Jr., I think for the Fairmont area, who's a Union officer. And he defeats him in that election. I really wish every West Virginian would read his inaugural address. Because in his inaugural address, he's talking about how we're going to put away all the issues between Unionists and Confederates. We're going to let the dead past bury its dead. We're going to move on to the living issues of the present, he says. And what he's looking at in terms of that address is how to develop those resources and the kinds of policies we need to develop those resources. We need simple legislation, less of it. We need to repeal laws if we're complicating things. We need to find ways to make sure that, you know, people outside of the state know about these mineral resources. He's going to be a champion of a geological survey so that, for the purpose of providing scientific information for possible outside investors. And so when you look at governors from him down to especially to McCorkle, and McCorkle is, you know, is the king of the boosters, without a doubt, doing everything he can to get investment into the state. McCorkle is somebody, by the way, who was part of a law firm in Charleston, and he says in his memoir published in 1928, you know, I smiled when the money came in. He basically became a millionaire making sure that railroads acquired title to land by using deeds, broad form deeds, by using old land warrants, by doing all that. You know, he became an incredibly wealthy man, you know, eventually governor of West Virginia. Statehood, you know, what would be the state of West Virginia, its creation is in 1863, but I think in 1872, you know, is just as important. And sometimes we don't think about 1872. It's not part of the eighth grade curriculum.
Right.
But, you know, it really, I mean, I kind of wonder, is Francis Pierpont and Arthur Borman the fathers of West Virginia, or is it Henry Mason Matthews and some of these characters in the 1870s who basically remake West Virginia in their own image and pursue policies that are extremely pro-business, extremely anti-labor. I mean, Matthews will be the first governor to use force against striking workers. First at the Great Railroad Strike in 1877, he telegraphs from the B&O Railroad Office to the President of the United States asking for troops. And then even against miners in 1879 in Anstead. And that will not be the last. And that's a story that will continue. Down obviously into the early 20th century.
Wow, for a state that is so little known, both in and outside the state, Keith, there is a rich history here to be tapped.
Oh, yeah. We have a fascinating history. We have a bloody history. We have a tragic history in so many ways. I mean, I think early 20th century in West Virginia. I mean, which we have
barely scratched.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the things that have taken place are just, things like, of course, obviously, like the Hawk's Nest tragedy. And of course, I have a problem using the term tragedy sometimes. I mean, Hawk's Nest a tragedy or is it a crime? I think it's a crime.
Yes, it absolutely is a crime.
Buffalo Creek, I mean, in 1972, of course, you know, the company's contention was that, you know,
act of God.
God. But I think someone said that they'd never seen God drive a coal truck up through there. But
right, and you know. And God didn't build that dirt and rock. And of course, the lesson we learned from Buffalo Creek was to build the dirt and rock dams higher and put more filth behind them.
Right.
Because remember, Buffalo Creek was just a few million gallons of toxic waste.
Right, yeah.
Whereas now, at the Brushy Fork impoundment in Western Raleigh County, Western Raleigh County,
right.
Is certified to hold something on the order of 9.8 billion gallons.
Right.
It is the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere, larger even than the Hoover Dam.
So I don't think bourbonism is quite dead. I mean, I know that, you know, especially since the New Deal, you know, obviously the union has a lot of power in West Virginia. But these companies, the origins of their ability to control, the state in some ways is really in that bourbon era. And those politicians, those political figures in that period, you know, governors like, you know, Matthews Fleming, Governor Fleming is another good example, you know, who was tied in with Fairmont Coal. I mean, you know, he was one of the investors. They talked about, you know, basically moving the state forward, and they did everything to bring these investors in, but they very often didn't seem to consider or care what some of the consequences could be. I mean, even
and a lot of what we've talked about has been Southern West Virginia in a way,
yeah.
Or maybe that's how I think about it. But the mine disasters in Marion County,
right.
The
biggest one was Monongah, and Monongah's the largest mine explosion in American history.
And that's 1907, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's, you know, of course, that's in the northern part of the state.
And the coal company grudgingly granted to the widows and orphans of all those killed miners, and I mean grudgingly,
mm-hmm.
$70 in payment for their loss.
Yeah, and Governor Fleming, who was out of office, but was... He was an investor in the company, and in fact, his brother-in-law was also an investor in the company. He says to reporters that would be a nice Christmas present for them. I'm serious. He says that. But, I mean, if you read, for example, in that series of documents I was telling you about, there's an excerpt from an article in which he's talking about all the material. He's talking about it's such a shame that you have all this that has not been developed. You have all this area that's still in timber. And how can it be? We've got to find a way, you know.
They found a way, Keith, because there is. I mean, I've seen photographs. There's hardly a photograph at the by the first decade of the 20th century that you're going to find of West Virginia in which there's a tree left standing.
Right.
This entire state was deforested.
Yeah, by the 1920s, the virgin forest is gone. When we talk about the frontier period, that was a virgin forest. With massive trees, that was something else. By the 1920s, that's gone. And what we have now is second, third growth.
The forest that we know and that tourists will actually come and see.
Yeah.
Are scrub by comparison.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But if you go to many states, I mean, there's no forest at all. All right. So I guess it does, but it can't be nearly as impressive. It's a shame that we couldn't have saved some of it.
Well, you can go up to Cooper's Rock State Forest in Monongalia County
and see some,
and see the virgin hemlocks. And when you see them, it's all you can do is sit there and wonder at the fact that what you're looking at extended all the way to the Mississippi River once upon a time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, there's an overarching question here, and I want to just kind of lob this up there to you. And if you want to park it in the cheap seats, that's fine. This overarching question that arises out of bourbonism, that West Virginia, you know, could West Virginia create a native, and by native I mean internal, an infra economy, if you will, devils us to this day. I mean, there are a lot of people that I still talk to who are deeply committed to figuring out what a just transition, and that's the popular phrase for it, what a just transition away from coal looks like, because this state has been through boom and bust. There have been several times in which the coal companies have said, well, we've gotten all we can get. So goodbye. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thanks for everything. See ya.
Well, I think that
good luck.
Our leaders in the bourbons were definitely convinced that, you know, policy had to be favorable, tax policy had to be favorable. West Virginia, I don't think I've severed taxes until 1987, right? I think you probably know that.
Yeah.
I mean, to think.
Well, governors were ruined for even suggesting.
Marlin was ruined for sure. There were several governors who suggested. Atkinson suggested it. Around the turn of the 20th century, but it was very difficult to get anything through the legislature because, well, the legislature became dominated by these interests, the captains of industry. A good book on that, you know, for your listeners is John Alexander Williams, West Virginia and the Captains of Industry. He really kind of looks at things. For example, if you were in the state legislature in the 1880s, this Constitution of 1872 prohibited salaried workers for railroads, anyone who collected a salary from a railroad company from sitting in the legislature. But if you sat in the legislature, you had a free railroad pass. So wherever you're at in the state, you rode the train to Charleston.
And somehow that wasn't illegal.
No, it wasn't illegal. Some people wondered about it, I guess, and eventually, I think it's Governor Wilson who was concerned about it because he thought that the railroads were too powerful. And they were very powerful. Right? I mean,
the railroads basically midwifed the coal industry.
No railroads, no timber industry, no coal industry. Couldn't happen. Had to have that in order to get it out.
My great grandfather was a section boss, laying the track through the New River Gorge.
Right, and it required a lot of things. It required lawyers, and that's how McCorkle and them made their money. As a Chilton McCorkle and Chilton and Kennan and Watts, those law firms out of Charleston, and it required, of course, the expenditure of quite a bit of capital before you made a single dime. And it was a blessing and a curse for West Virginians because, it brought, it gave you an opportunity, for farmers, for example, it gave you a chance to get to markets, but it also brought in agricultural products from areas like Ohio and Indiana, et cetera, that were hard to compete with even within the state. So, it's easier to get, corn from Ohio than to grow it here in some ways. It was a double-edged sword. Usually, railroad companies would have secret rates for especially like coal producers or timber interests. So, farmers always felt that they were the victims of
stuff that we would
discrimination.
If we had stuff that gave rise to the Sherman Act.
Right, exactly. Which the Sherman Antitrust Act would be used initially more against unions than against companies, at least until Theodore Roosevelt, right? And in the Northern Securities case, and that's why that's such a stunning moment when Roosevelt and the federal government are saying that you know you have to have the public interest in mind. You cannot go against the public interest, and making an example of Morgan and him in the process.
So what we know, and even the coal industry sort of obliquely admits this. Especially when they have to file things with the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
Time is running out in this state, at least where coal is concerned. And yet we have a vast segment of the population who still has coal keeps the lights on and friends of coal signs in their yards. And I don't want to debate I don't necessarily know that we would debate the rightness or wrongness of that.
Right.
But at some point in time, history, people tend to think that history is something that happened in the past, but I maintain that history is something that you live every day.
Yeah, and we're a product of, I think that, if you look at...
We're a product of past history and progenitors of future history.
Yeah, and if you look at, there are towns and there are places in southern West Virginia in which, at one time, I lived near Hinton. I mean, in Hinton, in 1912, I mentioned Theodore Roosevelt. In 1912, Theodore Roosevelt did several whistle stop speeches in the Bull Moose campaign in West Virginia. One was in Hinton, one was in Montgomery, Charleston, obviously, and in Point Pleasant. Think about it: Hinton, Montgomery, Point Pleasant—they were booming towns in 1912, and today they're not. Right? And today, what had made them successful, and there's all kinds of places in West Virginia that are like that.
And I guess the question is, will the West Virginia that we understand in 2013, Keith, simply be consigned to its fate, or is there something that, I was raised in Alabama, but I came back here because I had been raised with a reverence and an absolute love for this place by my transplanted parents.
Mm-hmm.
Such that I became the only one in my family who came back and lived here.
Okay.
But and now we've, you know, and you know Ferg, and you know Margie, and you know you know Doodle. How understanding Robert Penn Warren at the end of All the King's Men makes reference to the awful responsibility of time.
Right.
And as a child of the past and a progenitor of the future, all of us. When that day dawns in what could be 30 years or less in this state, when they pack their bags again and, you know, say goodbye and thanks for all the fish, how does West Virginia begin to redefine itself or define it? Is this finally the moment when West Virginia gets to define its own future?
If that's the case, I'm not really sure what kind of future it will be. And it's easy to identify the problems. It's not easy to identify the answer. In fact, this is something I've struggled with. As long as I've been teaching West Virginia history, it's easy to kind of see. It's a lot easier to see how things came about, how we got to where we're at, than it is to see how we can avoid, avoid what seems to be ahead. Eventually, West Virginia has to have something else. And I think even Robert Byrd kind of arrived at that conclusion near the end of his life. And no one's going to say that he was in terms of his entire career, that he was an enemy of the coal industry.
Yeah, not even wild-eyed critic.
No. In fact, that's part of the problem. You cannot have much of a political career in the state of West Virginia if you are really critical of the coal industry. What the answer to that is, what we're going to do, I mean, obviously, you know, we have to find, I think tourism is certainly important in West Virginia. Can we base an economy on it? I'm not sure. I think that West Virginia, I wonder if West Virginia may end up being a place for retirement at some point. But what kind of frightens me about it?
What kind of economy is that?
Yeah, that's not much of an economy. But what kind of frightens me about it, and I know you know this because you have teenage children, is I assume that my son will probably not live in West Virginia. Partly because he tells me he's not going to live in West Virginia.
Well, it's between that and the you got to leave.
Right, yeah.
I mean, there are real questions as to the degree to which this state has been rendered, especially the southern portion of it, has been rendered toxic for human habitation. And we
have other problems, too. I mean, we have problems in terms of drugs. For example, drugs are a serious problem in West Virginia, and even in southern West Virginia in particular. But isn't that,
Keith, incident to the economic state of malaise to which southern West Virginia has been subjected?
May well be.
I mean, I've made an argument on this program, and again, this is one of those things that's kind of inflammatory, but I'll go to the mattresses with this one. You can draw a parallel or at least a reasonable comparison between the sense of hopelessness that attends the life of a 12-year-old in the Gaza Strip with a 12-year-old in McDowell County. There's nothing for either one of them. In fact, you might even argue that the 12-year-old in the Gaza Strip has more hope because nothing is being done here, Keith.
Well, yeah, so their main hope for anybody, of course, who's growing up here is obviously to go somewhere else.
And that, of course, is something that we recognize as being the phenomenon known as brain drain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it affects us. It's going to affect us in all kinds of different ways. In fact, it already has. I mean, think about it. How much population West Virginia lost even in the 1950s? And, of course, that affects your representation in Congress, right? Every census, if you if you lose enough population, therefore you lose seats in the House of Representatives.
That was my father leaving in 1959, 1960. He was a furnace operator at Alloy down the mountain here, and got a better offer from a startup outfit in Northwest Alabama, and said, "I'm out of here."
Well, that's my father-in-law's story too. And when I go to visit them, they live just south of Cleveland, in a suburb of Cleveland. And I went to their church, and they go to a considerably good-sized Baptist church there south of Cleveland. And, you know, everybody there, you know, well, not everybody, but there's so many of the, especially the older folks there, who are from West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, who, you know, had mined coal, and for some reason or other, we're not going to mine coal. They lost their jobs, and they went to Ohio. And now there are so many West Virginians in North Carolina. You can go to North Carolina and go to a football game, and end up meeting all kinds of West Virginians all sitting around, but they live in North Carolina now. Right?
So, you know what? If you wear something with West Virginia on it, no matter where you go in this country,
yeah,
somebody will go, brother, cousin.
Yeah, if they find out where you're where you're from, they'll ask you, you know, exactly what town or what county, and they'll say, well, okay, I know where that's at, and you know, that kind of thing.
It's charming in its way, but it's also also a sad example of an internal diaspora inside this country.
Yeah, it is, and I don't know the answer to it, and I wish I did.
Well, I think it's worth some skull sweat. You know what, Keith? I've kept you longer than I said I would. I thank you so much for the graciousness of the time that you've spent with us, because I could not have done even an iota of what you've done to lay out the history of this state on this monumental little occasion that it is, and I'm just profoundly grateful. And you know, not to do anything on air, but Dr. Bill's doing an hour a day. Maybe one of these days you ought to just join him on the phone and do a dialogue like you do the chats. You guys work great together, and you're welcome anytime as far as I'm concerned.
I would like to do that, because I'm teaching a class this first summer term, and I'm teaching while he's doing that. Or I probably would have called in. I like doing those programs with him. I know that your listeners, many of them are familiar with them. But, you know, every time he tells me, I don't know what we're going to say. I don't know what we're going to
Every blessed day.
Yeah.
Every time I don't know what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. But we never have any shortage of things to discuss.
No, a long time ago, I came to the conclusion that the Prism Chat should be 3 hours instead of two.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm just running the equipment.
Yeah, we probably could do 3 hours. Of course, you know, we might be a little tired by that particular point. And we've also had some good guests on, too. And you know, there are people in this area, in this community, and in the institutions around here. We've had, you know, a couple from New River Community and Technical College, you know, Willis Nordland and Michael Curry. And, you know, there are people that can really contribute to a dialogue. And sometimes I'm just kind of glad to be, you know, part of the program, right, just to be there and soak some of it in. And I always enjoy that. And I really appreciate an opportunity to do this today, because I was thinking, well, this is West Virginia Day, and I didn't get invited to anything. I didn't go anywhere. You know, I taught classes, and so this was kind of my chance to kind of celebrate West Virginia Day, and I really appreciate that.
Well, it's been an absolute joy, and maybe at some point in the future, I don't know, maybe around Labor Day, we can talk about the labor history of this state. And perhaps even and sort of come a little further toward the future,
mm-hmm.
because there's so much about West Virginia that so many people don't know, and frankly should know.
Yeah, because there's so much about West Virginia I don't know. I'm always learning something new.
Well, you know, Jeff Biggers made the argument in his award-winning book, The United States of Appalachia, that so many people don't know that so much that we recognize as being quintessentially American arises out of Appalachia, generally, and specifically out of West Virginia. And maybe going back and having another look at that phenomenon and the history surrounding it would be valuable. But for the time being, I will simply say thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Keith Lilly. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Oh, you too.
Bye now.
Bye.
I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Professor Keith Lilly, of Concord University knows more West, has forgotten more West Virginia history than I will ever know. And there's, there's no end to my gratitude for his having taken time at very, very short notice to give us a little bit of background on this, the 150th anniversary of the creation of this state, and why it is that those of us who live here, despite all the conflict, despite all the pain, despite the inconvenience, why we do, God help us all, love it so. So it's after 2 hours, I'd say it's time to take a break. This is, after all, Conversation Radio, and you're welcome to chime in with whatever happens to be on your mind. You know the number, 304-658-3333. If you want to jump in via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact number. There are stories I'd love to get after, and will, if we're not conversating. I can fill a Bobster for another hour. I especially want to thank Lottie and Jeff and Daniel and Kate for helping get a long way toward meeting Robert's Down Under Challenge for this, the 20th day of June 2013. We now need, just as a reminder, because I only mentioned it once, Robert in Australia has issued his monthly Australian Down Under Challenge, and he heard me talking about what a hole we're getting into in a hurry. And so he put $300 on the table in the hopes that it will be matched by you so that we can catch up and get back out of the hole. I'm proud to say that we are $160 toward meeting that challenge. That means there's only 140 more to go to meet it. And we've got an hour to do it in, or, well, maybe between now and tomorrow night, but it's much better if we just get it done. $140, 14 at 10, 10 at 14, 7 at 20. Oh, you know, me, math on the fly. But it will make bill paying considerably simpler because, you know, the bills, never mind, well, the bills ye have always with ye. Right? Yeah, it's about the size of it. So, a little break. A couple of pieces of music that I have in mind. I thought we'd start with something. She just died in the last year. Hazel Dickens. She was, for all intents and purposes, the unofficial balladeer, as far as I'm concerned, of West Virginia. And since we've spent 2 hours talking about West Virginia, and I know there's other topicalities out there, there's other news stories, but when's the last time that there weren't people dead in a hole somewhere in West Virginia that we actually talked at any length about what West Virginia really means? I dare say this will be the only broadcast going nationally and internationally, for that matter, that spends the time on West Virginia's origins that we have spent this evening. And I don't feel at all bad about that. So, from Hazel Dickens, a little something for our break. This is The Horn. Happy birthday, West Virginia. Bob Kincaid.
West Virginia, oh my home. West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still and the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home. There.
about got the best of me. I can't remember why I left so free, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to see. But I can sure remember where I come from. West Virginia.
Hills of home, hills of home.
you why I played it. Hazel Dickens, West Virginia, My Home, and Hills of Home. Special, huh? Yeah. Thanks to Darlene, and thanks to Sal for helping out with our fundraising this evening. We are now, and thanks to Brandon, we are now, thanks to all of you, only $5 away from meeting Robert's Down Under Challenge. Thank you very much on this rather special day here in the hills and hollers. Kate writes in, please add $40 to Robert's money. You and Keith are such a refreshing change. Sleazy clergy and idiot politicians and the constant misogynistic, homophobic battering get tiresome. This discussion has been entertaining, informative, and interesting. We all have interesting kin. Yours are extraordinary. And I enjoyed the walk you took at the top of the show. I have fond memories of the time I spent down at Pipestem. It's a state park here in West Virginia. Down not too far from where Keith teaches and not far from where he lives. For a long weekend back in 09, it's called the Appalachian, and there's another place in that area called the Appalachian Folklife Center that's really special as well. Kate continues, I was all alone there at Pipestem, camped at the top of a beautiful ridge. I was sorry to leave. I have less fond memories from the mid-90s on the winding roads trying to stay out of the way of the monster coal trucks. Funny how the less fond memories of West Virginia often center on coal, coal trucks, coal trains, coal mines. Yeah. Kate says, I have never felt that it was home dirt for me, as my kin all came from North Carolina and Greene County, Tennessee. But I love how y'all sound. Thanks, Kate. Kate says, happy birthday, West Virginia. I love how y'all talk. This is a special place. And when you hear in the plaintive yearnings for home in music by somebody like Hazel Dickens, she's not exaggerating. I dare say that for the vast majority of people who come from here, no matter where they wind up, even if it's in a beautiful, extraordinary, exquisite place, at some point in time, in the dark and still of the night, like Hazel sings, there's a tug. And it is as if magnetic north has suddenly shifted to the Trans-Allegheny that became West Virginia. The beautiful, for instance, if you go to Wikipedia, just to give you an idea, you know, one of the things about radio is that we get to use our imaginations. And we imagine where someone is. Well, imagine no longer. If you've ever wondered, what's that place Bob's talking about all the time? If you simply look up History of West Virginia on Wikipedia, the first photo you will see attached to it is where I live. It's 2-3 miles. From where I live. It is the overlook from what is known today as Hawk's Nest. But in a former day, it was known as Marshall's Pillars, for it was explored by none other than the man who would go on to basically define the role of the judiciary in America, in the country, in the young republic. John Marshall. There's a dam in this photo. There's a dam just out of sight. You may have heard Keith Lilly refer to the Hawk's Nest disaster, called by some a tragedy, and he said, I think it was more of a crime, and it was, because the history of this state is suffused with the blood-soaked crimes of the moneyed class who give not a tinker's damn about what happens to the people that they use to create their wealth. You may not realize it, but probably somewhere not far from where you're sitting, no matter where you are on this planet, there very well likely is a West Virginian who has hoisted a glass to his or her home dirt on this 20th day of June 2013, because of how incredibly special it is. It is not susceptible to the vast farming of the Great Plains. It is not susceptible to the plantation agriculture that defined the southern states of the early part of this country. Hell, it's not even susceptible to the stony farming, although it's most similar to the stone soiled farming of New England. Your ancestors, my ancestors, found as much of a patch as they could work, and worked it to survive. And in surviving, never necessarily knew that they were poor. That's a bit of a cliche, but it's also true. But yeah, if you go to History of West Virginia in Wikipedia, you can see the New River Gorge at Hawk's Nest, which is 3 miles from where this broadcast is taking place. And it is a lovely place. But of all the people who should be celebrating West Virginia Day, and by God, some of them are doing it, some have a right to celebrate more than others. Those of us whose forebears have been here since before there was a West Virginia, and in fact, almost before there was a Virginia, and have blood running in our veins from before there were white people here, and I've got a drop or two of that, having a special right to celebrate. But the real celebrating, the real champagne cork popping, will be being done by the likes of Chris Klein and Jim Justice and Don Blankenship and Kevin Crutchfield and the vast army of lawyers that they have used to rip the wealth out of this place and away from the people who struggled to create it. In point of fact, this 150th anniversary of the state of West Virginia gives rise to a celebration, a banquet among thieves. For make no mistake, this place has been beset by thieves from the moment that John Peter Sally first found coal in the valley of what is now referred to as the Coal River. Which takes me to a story, and I think it an appropriate one for this. Well, let me back up. I want to share something. In her note, Kate said, we all have interesting kin. Yours are extraordinary. There's nothing extraordinary about them. They were simply desperate to survive. And they weren't having a hell of a lot of luck at it wherever it was they were. I'll never forget the look on Ferg's face back when we took the Lib Boat cruise a couple of years back, and found ourselves in San Juan Harbor in Puerto Rico, moored not at all far from where the replica ship of the HMS Bounty was moored. Of course, that was that lovely that lovely recreation was sent to the bottom of the sea with her captain not too long back off Cape Hatteras during a hurricane. But we went aboard. It cost like $5 or something. It was no big deal. And just got to walk around the ship for a little bit. And to call it a ship, I mean, it was a ship in its day, but it was terrifying in its size if you consider 15, 20, 30, 50 people trying to remain alive aboard it as it tossed and rolled and pitched across the North Atlantic. And there was a look of stunned amazement on Ferd's face when I said, think about it, boy. Whether they were Kincaids or Goads or Gwynns or Welches or Davises, they all got here on one of those, or worse. And it was a good 6-week ride. Well, it was a 6-week ride. How good it was, we'll leave that open to debate, because there aren't a lot of surviving records of how they felt about it. Maybe it was one of those less said, the better sort of situations. Some of them even took that ride knowing that they were riding into slavery. They had sold their own bodies in indentured servitude just to get the hell out of wherever they were. Just to have a puncher's chance at not dying sooner rather than later. It's a hell of a puncher's chance. A lot of boats didn't make it. So in particular, the story of the guy I mentioned at the top of the show, William McClung, later to be called Long Billy, the third, probably the first, this history says, child of John and Janet Thompson McClung, born about 1738. He married about 1766 to Abigail Dickinson. The Dickinsons came down through Pennsylvania. See the earlier part of the program. But in 1773, he immigrated with his wife and three children from Rockbridge County, Virginia, to the mouth of Big Clear Creek near Rupert, West Virginia. This account merely says, on account of the Indians, he soon moved to near Williamsburg, West Virginia, where he resided 3 years to be near Fort Donelly, Fort Donelly being a string of forts that were put up to guard what was the wild western frontier. They weren't very successful forts. They did prove themselves successful in terms of being combustible, because the natives, who did not much care to have their homelands stolen from them, tended to set fire to, with, I would argue, good cause. But he returned to Big Clear Creek about 1776, Long Billy did. He was the first settler on the Meadow River. The area became known as McClung's Meadows. The river later became the Meadow River. And you may have heard about, Professor Keith talking about how the land laws of Virginia allowed for white folks to steal land as long as they had improved it, and improving it was defined as walking along it and hacking at trees with tomahawks to lay a claim. Well, Long Billy McClung took a tomahawk entry for a few thousand acres on land on Meadow River and its tributaries. When he first raised his cabin, There was not a store or mill in many miles of his lonely habitation. Then this line, naturally written by a white person. The Indians were so troublesome. Well, you reckon Long Billy was troublesome to the Indians? Now, we just described McClung's Meadows, which must have been one of those rare, lovely, flat places in what would become West Virginia, where a fella could hope to eke out a subsistence living, raising, how about that, native crops, I'll be damned, corn, beans, squash, chilies, peppers, melons. Well, the melons came from Africa, and we know how that happened. Hello, Columbian Exchange! The Indians were so troublesome. I think we could probably rewrite that to, he was so troublesome to the Indians from whom he was stealing land, that he plowed with his rifle tied to his shoulder. Well, it wasn't a rifle. This is not professional history. It was a musket. It did not have a rifled barrel. He plowed with his musket tied to his shoulder, while his wife, you'll remember her name is Abigail. Abby. Abby who? Abby Normal. While his wife, I ought not talk about great-great-great-great-great-great-granny that way now, should I? He plowed with his musket tied to his shoulder, while his wife with her musket and three little children, think about this, took refuge in the dense swamp during the day, returning to the cabin only at night, when he was there to defend them. Imagine that. Subsistence lifestyle, you're up with the sun and out to try to raise an existence. Now, Ma, you take the young'uns, and there wound up being like 16 of them. You take the young'uns and go hide out in the swamps. Take your musket with you, sweetheart. Keep your powder dry. Maybe take your sewing with you. Yeah, it was a brutal, brutal time. And of course, whether he realized it or not, Long Billy was being used by shock troops by the white planters. He was of Scots-Irish descent, McClung. The Scots-Irish were used as shock troops by the well-heeled land-owning planters of the Tidewater to go in and clean out and do the genocidal dirty work that the planters didn't want to get their little pity-pats dirty on. But he succeeded, somehow, probably with no small amount of blood on his own hands. In partnership with General Andrew Moore, his brother-in-law, and Alexander Welch, more kinfolks, he patented a tract of land containing 43,000 acres lying between the Meadow River and the Gauley in what is now Nicholas County, West Virginia. In 1782, William entered 230 acres on Slab Camp Creek, including 100 acres of a military warrant, part of a survey made for William in 1776. It says here he was very tall and handsome in appearance. This is the fun part. Okay, not the fun, very tall. I have nothing to do with the tall. Okay, tall. I got nothing to do with the handsome part. He was very tall and handsome in appearance, a good conversationalist, and a most estimable citizen. He was a Presbyterian, he's Scots, remember, and donated 2 acres of land on Otter Creek, 1 mile west of Meadow Bluff, for the erection of a church. Now listen, just because we've got erection and church in the same clause does not mean you people have to giggle. The church later came into the possession of the Baptists. Well, they're like that, those Baptists. They're a little grabby. the Amwell Baptist Church near Rupert being the outgrowth. He was an elder in the Old Stone Church in Lewisburg, which he would travel 20 miles to attend. He also served in the Revolutionary War. The monument on his grave states, Virginia, Ensign, Virginia Militia, Revolutionary War. In 1777, the claims record of Virginia, William turned in the following claim, Bacon, sold to Captain Arbuckle. Decent cook. Foodie. Late 18th century foodie. And that's just one of them. It goes on and on and on. Seeing things like literacy disappear. When your everyday is spent out working your crops with a musket slung over your shoulder and your wife's hiding in the swamps. And that was his reality, but the reality of a lot of others. That book learning goes away. Even if the people who came here were about as literate as one could expect one human being to be at any point in Western European society. One of my multi-greats was a book publisher in Edinburgh. Yeah, Scotland, Edinburgh. His sons would eventually have children over here who never learned to read. And literacy was regained in fits and starts and desperate determination. Because someone made a decision along the way, you know, a group, a people, a common weal, decided it might be good to teach some reading. That an educated populace was the only kind of populace that could ever be trusted to maintain its own freedom. And ultimately, it winds up with balding, white-haired, bearded, fat man sitting in a chair in a tumbled-down, falling-apart house in West Virginia, talking about the world we all live in, with a variety of wildly intelligent people from all over the country and all over the world. That's pretty damned amazing. Not the me part, the them part. We are the children of our past and the fathers and mothers of the future. More, but first to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm fine. I've enjoyed the program today.
Well, thank you.
My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, would be 150 years old. She was born in 1863.
Wow.
Wow.
My great grandfather would be 148.
148. Well, I have a transcript of my grandmother's great grandfather, and it was written in 1830, I think. And most of it, he was leaving people to other people, which I find very disgusting. But anyway, there was one part of it that I thought was rather entertaining. To his beloved wife, he left this slave girl of 14 to be hers for the rest of her life. And he left to her his mulatto slave named Samson. Now, I've never figured that out. Why would he leave that mulatto slave named Samson to his wife?
Well, I'm sure I can't imagine.
Well, I got into trouble one time. It came up, and one of my cousins mentioned that or something, and I said, I don't know, but I bet the old girl died with a smile on her face. My cousin never spoke to me again, but that was all right. I didn't like her anyway. I'm such a trash mouth. But all that to me, I'm so glad you remember and have thoughts of your history, because I find that most people don't know diddly squat about where they came from and where their families came from.
Well, and you know, people who are rootless are easier to control. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, I suppose so. Well, anyway, I just wanted to wish West Virginia a happy birthday.
Well, thank you very kindly, Ed.
Along with my beloved grandmother, Susan, who lived to be, she was very old. She died in 1945. And I have a picture of her taken in the 1890s. And she
aren't those old photographs just wonderful?
Yeah, Ed, she was a wonderful lady, and I loved her forever. And I still miss her till this day.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, you take care.
All right, you have a good evening, Edward.
Well, you do too. Enjoy the program.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Calling from the Dallas area, that's our buddy Edward. I'm glad this has some resonance. Thank you very much. And thank you. Thank you. I need to make sure this that I get this mentioned. Thank you very much, Rob, for pushing us over the line. We have met Robert and Australia's 20th of the month challenge. And that is going to engender some absolutely wild bill paying. And I'm looking forward to it. It's fun to pay bills and know that, you know, stuff's going to keep staying on. Let's go to the Skype line. Will is joining us.
Hey, Bob. First, happy birthday to West Virginia. Thank you and several other people associated with you for helping us understand a part of the country that often gets ignored or neglected.
Well, thank you very much, Will.
As I mentioned in chat, it's also my mom's birthday. She's out visiting her sister as opposed to going out dancing, which she does in her 70s. And I hope she'll be around for a while.
I hope she's dancing into her 90s.
Well, I have a great aunt who's 98 and living on her own. And if you take care of yourself, you may make it. And this is one of the challenges that people in Appalachia and West Virginia have, trying to take care of themselves, because the whole point of the AIC Act is to help ensure that the health problems which are cropping up in your area, which are similar to those which happen in places like Gary and parts of Chicago and parts of the industrial belts of most major cities, can have a better future. And I mean, here's...
Let me emphasize something, Will. A return to a better future. It won't be new, because at a time, and this is one of those little-known hillbilly facts, at a time when the average lifespan in the United States of America was in the 50s, and of course that takes in people who were living in the squalor of the big cities and industrial accidents and so forth. In Appalachia, if you didn't get some disease, and remember, smallpox and polio and things like that were whooping cough and membranous croup, and there are stories. But if you survived that, then you had a better chance of living to great age than just about anybody except the super rich. I can go into family cemeteries. You know, Professor Keith was talking about how fascinating it is and how much you can tell about a community just by walking through its cemeteries. I can and find my forebears living, in some cases, up into their high 90s.
Yes.
At a time when their diet consisted of gravy with gravy on it and some grease on the side.
Ironically, some of those diets might have been better than what a lot of the rest of the country was having, simply because you could supplement it with something grown from the earth. And my hope is that we will see West Virginia in the next few decades cast off the chains of King Coal, have more renewable energy, and have the resources to fully develop as the people wish. Not the companies, the people. I mean,
exactly.
Beautiful mountains, and leveling them is something that, well, they would have freaked out easily, but the Founding Fathers would say, they are doing what? And surely you jest. Sadly, it's not a joke. And I mean, there's so much potential. Wind, solar. I mean, literally, if you could set up wind turbines and solar panel farms all over West Virginia, you have a lot of places where you could ship that energy to. And guess what? Those are good paying jobs.
Yes, they are. And there's one thing I like to say, Will. Looking back at my forebears, in fact, I don't know, maybe someday we'll do a bumper sticker. It just says, Hillbillies, we were sustainable before sustainable was cool.
Yes. Well, ironically, the people that they learned a lot from, the native peoples of this continent, did focus on sustainability, and their cultures persisted for hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands, of years. And we are beginning to get back a little towards that wisdom, because more of us are asking, does our consumer-driven society ever push to grow and expand make sense on a limited planet? No. But I think that we will see some more good ideas coming from your area. And let me make a pitch for the horn. Right now, what Bob does, what's done on the horn, is really not done quite anywhere else. Yes, there are other independent progressive voices on the internet and the radio, and yes, they do deserve your support, but Bob is an expert in allowing the long form conversation. It isn't 5 minutes and then a hard break if someone calls in. Rather, you can be somewhat more flexible. And this is something that I'd like to see continue. I had a friend in Phoenix who, after being canned from the Progressive Talk station, ironically a few months before it went into the can, on his own for about a year and a half, kept a progressive radio network on the internet going, Jeff Farias. And he tried hard to raise funds. He tried to get backers. He even tried to see if he could get on the airwaves. But the day came, which he dreaded, where he had to say, I'm going to have to turn off the lights. I'll still speak up for the causes that I care about. And, Bob, I don't want to have to see you go through that, because it wasn't easy for a man I consider a friend. I don't want another friend to have to go through that. So, everyone, if you can give something to the horn, even if it's 99 cents, guess what? It adds up. We have to remember what allowed Bob's ancestors to survive was a sense of community. And that is likely what's going to get us through a lot of the problems of our time as well.
Well, thank you, Will. You know, you speak a lot of truth there. We will... this year, this past May, we passed 10 years since I came back to the microphone, and I came back thanks to Dr. Bill O'Brien. I started out filling in for him when I came back to radio over in America's fifth smallest radio market. And by February of 2004, we were on the air thanks to the Affiliated Construction Trades Foundation of West Virginia. And when I got booted off terrestrial air, it was thanks to the carpenters and millwrights of West Virginia that we got back on via the internet. So, but after that, everything that happened has been strictly a matter of listener support. I didn't want to go with that model. It wasn't my idea of success or sustainability, but it has proven to be sustainable as long as I and the folks who are doing this are willing to do it without pay. And so, you know, that and it's that important to me. It's right. not just something that I do to kill 3 hours a day.
No, rather this is something you believe in very strongly, and you're willing to take time and resources to make it happen. And this is where community-supported radio really can make a difference. I think one thing we have to remember is the problems you face in West Virginia are not so dissimilar from what many are facing elsewhere in this country and this world, and that when we learn from each other, we can get a lot stronger. This is why we have to continue the dialogue amongst ourselves, not just on the horn, but in our society, because the forces that are arrayed against the interests of the common man are great. On the other hand, we have numbers, and we are able to make some progress. And the way we do that is marching hand in hand. The billy clubs might be out on the bridge, but we're still willing to walk forward and ultimately move towards a better day.
True, true, Will. Better words have not been spoken. You know, I would hope that folks, you know, just as people who learned to stand up here in the Mountaintop Removal Sacrifice Zone learned from people who had gone before, I hope, Will, that other people who are battling against fracking, who are yeah. battling the Keystone XL pipeline, who are battling to save their homes in places like northern Wisconsin or even Alberta, Canada, can take a little bit of inspiration from us, because this is a coal industry that will not hesitate to threaten and even harm people. So if people can stand up against power here, they can do it anywhere.
Correct. And there has been a fine tradition of that in your state, and we need to learn from each other that we have the power to create change in our lives, because the one message that any tyranny says, regardless of how it classifies itself ideologically, is you, the little people, have no power. You will have to do what we say because we are all powerful. You cannot fight City Hall. And the history of resistance is saying no to that and waking up and realizing we have our own strength. And it's a good idea if the various ecological movements and social movements could actually send people to sit down and take notes, because we all have a lot to learn from each other. Maybe some of the tactics that are being used in Alberta will work well in Appalachia or vice versa. We really have to realize our own strength. And there's so much in our society that says we don't matter, and we have to reject it. This is why the people of Coal River Mountain Watch are making a difference, because they realize even if a lot of their neighbors are apathetic or speaking against them, a few voices will ultimately create change. And we have to realize it's in the long haul. I mean, this is why I have hope, simply because I know so many other social movements had to take a great deal of time to happen. The people on the prairies and the populist movement, the progressives in the cities in the 1890s, early 1900s, did not see many of the seeds they plant bear fruit until the New Deal. And yet, some of them were still able to see it. And even those who did not knew that they were planting not just for themselves, but for future generations. And that's what we have to do. Even if we don't expect to see the results in our lifetime, we can choose to make a difference. Because if we don't, who will? In the end, it's up to us.
in the end, what's the Margaret Mead quote about?
I believe that the only thing that, I'd paraphrase it, but the only thing that changes the world is a small group of dedicated people, and it's the only thing that ever has.
That's quote, but there's a front end to it in which she says, people ask me, there it is. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, and this is the kick, indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
Yes. Well, remember, it was a very small band of patriots who decided that they no longer wished to be ruled from overseas. It was a very small group of people who first organized against slavery, who first organized for women's suffrage, who organized for better labor and working conditions, and such things begin small, but like a boulder rolling downhill, it can gather speed, particularly if it's given a push in the right direction.
Well, amen, amen, amen. Will, I really appreciate your comments, and I appreciate your thoughts, and thank you for the very, very kind words about this humble effort that happens every night here. That means a tremendous degree.
May you be doing this for at least another 10 years, and may we see King Cole lose his crown and being reduced to selling pencils on the streets of Charleston, West Virginia.
King Cole in rags. Hear, 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 hear. A fitting toast on this 150th birthday of the state of West Virginia. Thank you. Thank you very much, Will.
Good night.
Have a good night. Will from Chicago. Mighty nice words. So, we're pretty much at the end of the program for the evening. I sure do appreciate your forbearance. We had stories. I've got one that's going to wind up being in the stack for tomorrow night, because when I said the thieves need to be celebrating the hardest because they've become the richest, well, Texas Betsy alerted me to a Joe Manchin story, and I was trying to remain on rather an even keel this evening and not run screaming off into the night, but this is one of those screamers, so maybe we'll save that for Friday on the front porch if that's okay. Thanks again to all of you who responded to Robert's challenge from Australia, Robert's Australia challenge for the 20th of the month. We made it. Thanks to all of you. Again, thanks to Kate. Thanks to Sal. Thanks to Rob. Thanks to Brandon. Thanks to Daniel. Thanks to Darlene. Thanks to Jeff. Thanks to Lottie. Thank you all profoundly, because this is the only thing that stands between me, you, and, well, not even a test tone, just silence. And it is, never, never doubt for a moment, deeply inspiring, deeply. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas of long-standing, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and yes, ACHEACT, ACHEACT.org, ACHEACT.org. That's where you go if you, no matter where you are, want to help us build a better Appalachia. And by building a better Appalachia, yes, a better America. Thank you all most profoundly. And one last time, happy birthday, Happy 150th birthday, West Virginia, and all the good you have made, and maybe may the evil be overcome. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.